This is Spirit Network Radio, a PBS radio production hosted by renowned clairvoyant medium Francine Milano. Spirit Network is committed to the dawning age of enlightenment, from the psychic to the holistic. If it's on the mind, body, and spirit, it's on Spirit Network.
Hello, and welcome to Spirit Network. I'm your host, Francine Milano, and I look forward to spending the next hour with you. Today, we're going to talk to a very well-known UFO abduction researcher, Kathleen Martin. She'll take your calls at 888-627-6008, or you can email your questions to radio@spiritnetwork.com. Before I introduce her, though, I want to mention a sponsorship for the show. In part, Spirit Network Radio is actually made possible by the support of our own Spirit Network Festival.
It's almost time for the Spirit Network Festival again. Join us at the Harrisburg Clarion Hotel and Conference Center on Sunday, April 27th in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Visit the Psychic Fair, meet with wellness practitioners, and browse through the vendors area for natural health and organic products, crystals, herbs, sacred jewelry, and all things metaphysical and holistic. Also, be sure to take in the mini lectures included with your $5 admission. Festival speakers this year include Francine Milano, Rini Panzini, Emily Givler, and Lynn Van Prague Grattan. Visit spiritnetwork.com for details and be good to your mind, body, and your spirit.
Now, this year, we're honored once again by having Crystal Sage in our vendor area, offering quality crystal infused oils, jewelry, and many other great products. Find out more at www.crystalsageoils.com. We're also blessed to have medium and animal communicator Jackie LeBeau back to offer readings in our psychic fair. Visit her website at www.jackielebeau.com. That's JACQUILEBEAU.com. Now, if you'd like to be a sponsor on Spirit Network. We have many advertising options as low as $50. Our shows are not just live, but they are archived on the BBS website, and the podcast is available on iTunes. So your message plays on to reach many people long after the broadcast. Simply email radio@spiritnetwork.com. Now today I have an amazing guest for you. And just to introduce her without a little fanfare wouldn't do. She's MUFON's Director of Abduction Research. In 2012, she was also the recipient of MUFON's UFOologists of the Year. And she's written and co-authored several books. She's lectured all over the United States and has been recognized globally for her work. And I feel honored that she's agreed to talk to us today. Kathleen Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Oh, it's really an honor. It really is. I have read your first book, Captured, and it's a fascinating story about where it really all began for you. So I was thinking we'll start at the beginning. If you would, could you tell us about the story of Betty and Barney Hill?
Sure. I was 13 in 1961 when my aunt and uncle returned home from a short vacation. They had been to Niagara Falls and then to Montreal, and they were driving home to their home on the seacoast of New Hampshire through upstate New Hampshire at night when they spotted a UFO in the sky. They called it a flying saucer back then. It came in very, very close to them, within 100 feet of their vehicle. It was large. It was silent. It hovered overhead. My uncle got out of the car with his binoculars and looked up at it and saw non-human entities looking back at him. This was all part of his conscious, continuous recall. My aunt wrote to Major Donald Kehoe only 6 days later at NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, and described the whole incident to him, how the craft had moved erratically, how it had moved in a stair-step pattern, the windows in the craft, and the description that my uncle had given of the beings, that they were dressed in black, shiny uniforms, and that something about their appearance had frightened him so badly that he'd developed a mental block and was even considering the possibility of hypnosis in order to try to uncover that mental block, that he had become so frightened by what he saw. She also spoke about a series of buzzing sounds that seemed to be striking the trunk of the vehicle after my uncle broke away because he thought that he was going to be captured. He ran back to the car, and the craft followed him and hovered over the top of the vehicle as he went driving very rapidly down U.S. Route 3 in upstate New Hampshire. They were driving and driving, and as if only a moment had passed, they found themselves on a new stretch of highway. They had no idea what had happened in the interim. They heard a second series of these buzzing sounds. They were looking for human contact, for a police officer they might report this to. They didn't see anyone at that time of night. They didn't realize that it was actually much later than they had anticipated. When they arrived home, it was 5 o'clock in the morning. Dawn was already streaking the sky. They anticipated arriving sometime between 2 or 3 in the morning. So they later discovered that it was a full 2 hours of time that they couldn't account for. And it was not until 1963 that they actually saw Dr. Benjamin Simon so that Barney could have this hypnosis that he had been seeking. And Ben Simon was a renowned psychiatrist from Boston. He'd worked very successfully with shell shock victims during World War II to help them recover and get on with their everyday life to return to work and their families. And Barney was having this type of symptom due to what he had observed and memories that were beginning to come back to him and to Betty, too. There was also physical evidence. The tops of Barney's best dress shoes were deeply scraped. Betty's dress was torn in several locations. There was actually a 2-inch tear in the stitching at the top of the zipper. The dress was torn from waist to hemline, and the hem was torn down on one side. There were shiny spots on the trunk of their vehicle that hadn't been there the day before, and they were magnetized. They caused a compass needle to spin and spin. The binocular strap that Barney had had around his neck was cleanly severed. He had pulled it away so hard, and he was in a little bit of pain from that as he ran back to his vehicle. The watches they had been wearing that night had stopped working and never ran again. So they had a lot of evidence that something had happened. They called my childhood home, Betty called my childhood home, the afternoon after they arrived home after having this very strange experience in New Hampshire's White Mountains. I heard it firsthand from Betty a couple of days later and actually saw the spots on the trunk of the vehicle, the watches that didn't work. I later heard that the dress she had worn had grown some kind of pink substance on it. There was a pink powdery substance that had discolored the dress and reduced it to a rag. It's been analyzed in scientific laboratories 5 different times. So it was quite a story, but we didn't really find out about what had actually occurred in full until 1964, when Betty and Barney, for a period of 6 months, visited Dr. Simon in his Boston office once a week. He hypnotized them separately. He induced amnesia at the end of each session so that they couldn't contaminate each other's information. They couldn't even remember what they had stated. yet they both came out with the same story of alien abduction, of being stopped in their vehicle on a lonely road. They didn't know how they'd arrived there. They were taken through the woods onto a craft. They were terrified, but they cooperated. Betty actually tried to fight. She tried to escape, and that's when she tore the dress from waist to hemline and the hem down. But they took control of her and gave Betty and Barney physical examinations and then released them.
So this, and I actually even watched the movie, which was is just as impressive as the book, actually. But this really was the first reported, or at least the first recognized report of a UFO abduction.
Yes, it was. It was the first that we knew of in that time frame. Now, there had been abduction in 1957 in Brazil, but we didn't know about that until the mid-60s in the United States.
Oh, okay. All right. So now let me ask you this. Now, this is like incredible. It's almost like you were born for this because it led you so far down a different path that you might have otherwise lived a whole different life. And it led you to working with a lot of people and writing other books. And tell us about the fascinating path that this took on, because, I mean, your life is exciting to me.
Well, it certainly did change the course of my life. My family had no interest in flying saucers before this had happened. We were interested in politics. My grandfather held political office in the town of Kingston, New Hampshire. He was the equivalent of the mayor of the city. He was chairman of the Board of Selectmen. He had been a road agent as well and an elected police officer at one time as well. My grandmother was very active in unionizing shops, factories in Amesbury, Massachusetts, near Kingston, where we lived. Betty had been involved in politics. Barney was involved in politics and very active in the civil rights movement as well. In fact, I went to Lyndon Johnson's inauguration with Betty and Barney. They were invited guests, and I was invited because I helped to campaign for Lyndon Johnson. So, wow. You know, I my life would have taken that course. I had wanted to go to medical school. I ended up not going. I ended up studying and becoming a social worker first, specializing in what was at that time called psychiatric social work. And they call it clinical social work now.
Right.
And then I went on and I taught school for many years. I decided I didn't like social work as much as I thought I would. And it wasn't until 1988 that I left my job and decided that I wanted to investigate my aunt and uncle's experience for myself. I studied. I became a MUFON field investigator and started to interview Betty, to do the research, to read her files. She had about 40 years worth of files with all the original reports, the letters to and from scientists. It was amazing how many scientists were actually interested in this case and in the evidence and learning about the characteristics of the craft and also learning about the characteristics of behavior of the ETs and their physical appearance as well. There was a wealth of information there.
So it was the mainstream scientific community that really did take notice? I mean, they cooperated and they really wanted to be interested in this?
Yes, there were many mainstream scientists, if you want to call them mainstream. I suppose if anyone knew about it, they would no longer be considered mainstream. But
there were
scientists who worked with Betty and Barney confidentially as well. And I've had to withhold some of that information in order to hide their identities, even today.
Oh, okay. Okay, so that's not really their names.
Well, the real names are in the book.
Oh, okay. Okay.
The ones that permitted me to use their names do have their
right.
names in the book.
But yeah. that's not the names they used in the movie.
Well, the only name that was changed that I can think of in the movie was Walter Webb. I don't know about the military men in the movie, if that was the same, or Dr. Simon's consultants in the movie. Mm-hmm. But I know that Walter Webb, who was the original NICAP investigator, who was an astronomer, had a different name in the movie.
Okay. So where this led to was starting to investigate other cases. And how did you meet Stanton T. Friedman?
Well, I believe, met Stan for the first time at my Aunt Betty's house when they were doing a television show, and he had flown from Canada into Boston to do an interview. And I started to attend UFO conferences, and mm-hmm. I was very, very impressed with Stan. As a meticulous researcher and for calling out the federal government for the cover-up, the cosmic Watergate, and he had written a number of books, and I really admired his work, and
so
Betty did as well.
So he helped you a lot with your writings and your book.
Well, what he did is Betty said to me, if you ever need any assistance in writing this book that she knew I was writing, I would recommend Stanton Friedman. He's honest and you can trust him.
Mm-hmm.
And so Stan actually was the person who was interested in the star map work, and I didn't talk about that yet. But
mm-hmm.
Betty was shown a star map when she was on the craft. And a brilliant woman from Ohio saw it in the first book that was ever written about the Hills experience, The Interrupted Journey. And she thought that if this place really existed in our galaxy, that she might be able to find it. Initially, she thought there'd be many matches, but in the end, she found only one. And it was from the star system of Zeta Reticuli, the net, that can be seen from the southern hemisphere. And so she had done all of this work, an extraordinary amount of work over several years before she had a match, but she couldn't find scientists who were willing to vet her work.
Mm-hmm.
And Stanton Friedman was asked to vet her work. And he brought in other scientists, astronomers, who did, and said that her work was accurate. So this was a big find. And the chance of this occurring, of actually finding this match and having it so accurate, was about 1 in 1,000,000. So this brought a lot of scientific interest to Betty's case as well. Stan spoke about it. He wrote about it. He supported Marjorie's work. And I asked him to join me in writing the book, and also he wrote the two chapters in Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience,
mm-hmm.
on the star map. One is called The Star Map Research, I think, and the other one is called Disbelievers and Disinformants, about the debunkers who attempted to refute the star map and the story in general.
Yeah.
So,
well, the star map was really fascinating.
Yes.
And is this where it was you were led to your next book, Science Was Wrong? Because
yes.
I had a time frame that I couldn't read all of your books. I'm looking forward to doing that.
Yes. Well, you know, Stan and I worked together very, very well. And after we wrote Captured, he wrote another book on his own, Flying Saucers and Science. And I read that book the manuscript for him and wrote a comment on that. And as time went on, we thought that we'd like to write another book together. We got along well. We had writing styles that were compatible. And so we decided to cooperate on another book, which was Science Was Wrong. and that is about startling truths about cures, theories, and inventions they declared impossible. So who is they? They were some very powerful, politically powerful, well-educated scientists dating back to at least 150 years. And the book is about proclamations of impossibility that they had made. And in the end, they were wrong. But there were social consequences to their debunking, to their holding up science, the scientific progress. And so that's what the book is about. It was a really fun to do the research for the book because a lot of it includes mainstream science. But in the end, we have three chapters. On one is on the research on psi phenomena. Another one is on alien abduction. And another one is on UFOs, mostly on large-scale scientific studies on UFOs. It's also a chapter on the hemophilia holocaust during the AIDS epidemic, the eugenics movement in America. I wrote those. Methyl mercury in our food chain, another chapter I wrote. Stan wrote a chapter on global warming, man or nature, and also chapters on smallpox. I wrote that. Personalities, politics, and childbed fever. Ignaz Semmelweis, who was the doctor who actually discovered that you could prevent a high mortality rate among women giving childbirth and for the infants as well, if only you would wash your hands before you gave internal examinations and delivered babies. And for his brilliance, he actually ended up losing his job for insubordination because his supervisor was tied to the zeitgeist of the old guard. And how could doctors possibly infect their patients when their hands were supposed to be healing hands? So pretty fascinating chapter. Stan also wrote on cold fusion or fraud, on communications. Chapter, fascinating chapter on Jupiter and Earth, and a little bit about astrology, a chapter on space and aviation.
Sounds like it was a very big book.
It isn't really long. Our publisher always sets a limit for us, but it's crammed with information.
It sounds like it is. And then you went on to another book I want to talk about before I bombard you with some questions. Denise Stoner is an abductee. Is that correct?
That is correct. She is.
And she co-wrote a book with you.
Yes, she wrote on some of the section about her experiences in the book. Mm-hmm. And fascinating story. I met Denise about 4 years ago. I had moved to Florida at the time, and she was the Mutual UFO Network's chief investigator at that time and was holding state section directors' meetings in Central Florida. And that's where I live, so I decided that I would attend her meetings. And that's how I met her. She also has been holding experiencers support meetings for the past 10 years. So she's very instrumental in helping other people to come to terms with the experiences that they're having. It's so important to have someone that you can talk to who's sympathetic and non-judgmental.
Absolutely.
You know, so I was impressed with Denise. She invited me to her meeting for experiencers, and she told me finally that she was an experiencer. It wasn't something that she generally shared. And her mother was at the meeting as well. And I decided that I'd like to investigate what of Denise's experiences. So we started out with some hypnosis after I did a preliminary investigation. And I'm trained in hypnosis and in forensic hypnosis as well. And so I started with some hypnosis sessions with her for an experience that she and her family had back in 1982 when they were driving from their home in Arvada, Colorado, to Buena Vista. And some people say it's Buena, but the locals call it Buena. I used to live in Colorado. Their trip was 137 miles. So every week in the summer, they would travel. They'd leave at the same time of night and travel to this trailer that they had on a camp, on a ranch in Buena Vista. And Denise's mother and father had a place right next to them there. And Mom would always have dinner ready, and they'd always expect Denise and Ed and their daughter to arrive at about 8 o'clock at night, you know, maybe 8:15 at the latest. So on this particular night, they were descending from Kenosha Pass into South Park Valley, and they're riding along when Denise spots these new lights in the sky, and she's watching them, and suddenly they come in very, very rapidly, and she's pointing them out to Ed. And she looks at him, and she sees that he's staring straight ahead and that his hands are on the steering wheel, gripping it very hard. And suddenly the car feels like it is beginning to leave the road and slide off to the side of the road. And they both consciously remembered this. As if only a moment had passed, they found themselves in a brand new location. They were 40 miles away from where they had been in what seemed a moment. And the car hadn't registered, the odometer hadn't registered that 40 miles. It was now dark. It had been 6:55 at night in the summer, Friday, August 13th. What a thing to happen on Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
But it was daylight. When Denise spotted these craft, and then it was 11 o'clock at night, suddenly, and it was dark, it was cold, they were freezing, and they did, the only thing they could do at that point is drive on. Denise's parents were very, very worried. They were about to call the police to see if they could go out and look for them if they'd been in an accident when Denise and Ed finally drove in. And everybody was greatly relieved, but they did not believe Ed and Denise initially. They thought there had to be a prosaic explanation for this, but in the end, there was not, and Ed and Denise were telling the truth. And as time went on, Denise came to think that some experiences that she had been having all of her life might be connected to this. And I haven't hypnotized her about those because they go way back to her early childhood. But she thinks that these might have started when she was 2.5 years old.
Wow.
In her bedroom. And since we wrote the book, Denise's mother has come forward and stated that she remembered a time when Denise was a little girl where she and her husband were in bed at night, and they saw a huge light coming in toward their big bedroom window, and they were watching it. They were fearful that it was a plane in free fall and that it was going to crash. And then suddenly, it was the next morning, and they had no explanation for what had happened, but it changed Denise's mother's behavior. She was beginning to realize that perhaps she had been taken as well,
yeah.
And perhaps that's why Denise was taken during her childhood. and as an adult and over again throughout her life. It's a fascinating story, and Denise has obtained a lot of information, messages that these ETs have given to her.
Very interesting. I mean, you know, I actually have a friend who, similar to Denise, that would wake up with nosebleeds and certain things that we've heard of before as far as symptomatic situations. But her mother also, it kind of woke her up to say she had had nosebleeds too, and they never connected these things. And I don't know if there had been any stories about lost time, but in all the investigations that you've done, is that uncommon to see, you know, parents and children also abducted through the years from their home?
Well, I'm finding that often this follows family genetic lines. And actually, I have to tell you that Dr. James Harder was, as far as I know, the first person to actually study this. And he's deceased now. He was one of the investigators on my Aunt Betty's case, and I knew him. He did find that it followed family genetic lines, and I'm finding that as well. Some people are taken initially as children. I've talked to many, many people, and a lot of men, as you know, you think that there are more women than men, but a lot of men have talked to me, maybe more men than women. And they're telling me that they were outside playing when they were kids. Maybe they were in a park or out in the woods with friends when a craft came down, and they were taken for the first time. And then they were taken periodically throughout their lifetime. When they had children, the children were also taken. It seems to follow family genetic lines.
And do you believe that's for study, or do you also believe that perhaps someone like Denise actually has some hybrid blood in her?
Well, I think that it's probably both. I don't know. I mean, I have no solid evidence that Denise has hybrid blood. I don't even know how we would be able to determine that if we have the capability of determining that. But it appears that the ETs are doing something to human fetuses, that perhaps they are actually using the sperm and the ova and creating the human fetus on the craft, and then implanting it into the woman's womb. Maybe the woman becomes pregnant, and maybe they remove the fetus that's there and substitute it with another fetus. I'm not sure how that happens. I'm speculating here. I don't even know if that's scientifically possible. But something is happening, apparently, where they are altering the a little bit the genetic makeup of the human.
And it's interesting because you're right. It's, you know, you have to be... You're working on your opinion because, you know,
that's
other people
right.
are going to just say, well, your tinfoil's showing.
Right. You know, and it is speculation, but it's also based upon information that's been given to me by experiencers.
I'm sure our science may not be able to tell, you know, what chromosome to look for or, you know, what kind of test to do. Maybe our science can't, but someone else's can. Now, I know that research is based on facts. I know it, science is based on facts. But it seems we have some questions for you, for your right brain today. If you are willing to interject some of your opinions, I do have some items in the mailbag for you. Okay? Are you ready?
Yes,
okay.
I am.
Now, more than one person... has asked me, they want to know why abductions are taking place to begin with. And what do you think they ultimately want?
Oh, what do they ultimately want? Well, yeah, that's another tinfoil hat question, really, because here I am speculating again.
Well, that's all this really is.
But,
it is just speculation.
What do I think they want? Mm-hmm. Personally, and based upon the information that experiencers have given to me as part of my research projects, I believe, or I think, that they might possibly be interested in altering the behavior of the human race. I have been told that they're very, very concerned about certain aspects of our behavior, that they're afraid that we might annihilate ourselves because of our behavior.
Well, they should probably change our agriculture system. Get the GMOs out of our food.
Right, that might be a good
idea.
That'd
be a lot of help.
Well.
We could use it on it. Is that what crop circles are about, perhaps? Okay. Well, now that's a good question. Now, again, remember, this is just your right brain, so we're not going to hold you down
okay.
to anything, okay? Shelley asked if one of my favorite quantum physics questions, this is cool, but in my own words, Kathleen, are ETs our ancestors? And is that who will become in the future?
There are some people and even some scientists who speculate that this could be true, that they could be our ancestors. I wonder myself because, well, it depends upon what kind of ETs you're talking about. If
this
it's the
true.
Human types, perhaps. But you're talking about the insectoid types who seem to have maybe exoskeletons and bodies that are entirely different than our own, then I doubt it. So it depends upon the species that you're talking about.
I see. Okay. So yeah, well, let's, on that vein, the different species that there are, educate us on what has been speculated upon. Because I know we have some that are supposedly from Pleiades that help us, and then there are the Greys that just give us a little rundown.
Yes, probably several races of Greys because there are physically different descriptions of them, different facial characteristics. But generally, there are two sizes of Greys. One is about 3.5 to 4 feet tall. Those are the workers or the helpers. There are the taller ones who are about 5 feet tall, and they are the scientists, the educators, the translators, the escorts. Some people even talk about tall Greys, taller than that, but very, very rarely do I hear that. Then I had mentioned the insectoid type, who tends to be about 5.5-6 feet tall. Some people say even taller. Very, very thin, possible exoskeleton.
The reptilians?
Some people mistake them for the reptilians.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
They have different body types and different behavior than reptilians. Their eyes are more vertical. They work with the Greys. They're seen working with the Greys. I have many, many reports from experiencers who have seen both working together on the same craft. And in fact, Denise Stoner is one of those. Mm-hmm. Then there is the reptilian, which that's a kind of a rugged figure. There are different species of reptilians also that have been described, from some that kind of look more like lizards or alligators, but they, they stand upright and they have very rugged bodies, to a particular type of draconian, where people say that they actually have a tail. And most people give negative reports about reptilian behavior and the reptilian brain, but I have spoken with some experiencers who have had very positive experiences, they say. So that's kind of a mixed bag, and I really don't specialize in that, so I'm more of a specialist in the Greys, so I I'm just going to leave that at that.
Okay,
and
that's
then,
good.
Of course,
no, of course, I actually have my own sources when I can't really say because I don't need any MIBs at my door. But my understanding is that is along the lines of our behavior, and that they're most concerned about nuclear war,
mm-hmm.
and that they will prevent that at whatever cost. Would you say there are certain species that we should be, that are more on our side and others that might have their own agenda? Like, who would be helping us the most, do you think?
Well, certainly the Nordic type, and also a lot of the grays, it appears, are helping us as well.
Mm.
I've heard very positive reports about some contact with the grays.
Really? Okay. And I have not heard those reports. I've heard some negatives, but you're more the expert.
They have a way of abducting people, you know, going and taking you very rapidly and scaring people
nice.
In the process of doing that. But then they can engage in some very kind behavior once you're on the craft. Jenny Henderson, who is the second experiencer that I wrote about in the Alien Abduction Files, has had some positive experiences with the grays. And there were several other stories in the book as well about other experiences. So it's not just Denise. There are several stories in this book.
Well, I believe that there are people here that may not be hybrids, maybe they are, but that they're working with them as ambassadors, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. They have certain ambassadors on Earth that, and I don't know that we all know who's working with them and who's not. I mean, they might not even know. It could be happening in their sleep. It could be happening through abduction.
Yeah,
but that they're really some really, really close relationships
mm-hmm.
with some people
they
here.
They tell some people here that they are part of them. And actually, Jenny Henderson was one of those people who
mm-hmm.
Received the message that she is part of them, that they love her. It's almost as if they're part of the same family.
Okay, so perhaps if there is a little bit of genetics that is placed in someone on Earth, then we tend to gravitate toward their agendas, you know, and helping them.
Yes.
But I know someone who feels that when she goes to sleep, that she, you know, she continues to have these dreams, and that there's all these conferences and meetings that she's always going to.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and that gets kind of, I know it gets a little deep, but, you know, I mean, we're both probably wearing our tinfoil now. But that's okay. That's what we're here for. It's, you know, mm-hmm. What does BBS Network say? If it's not mainstream, it's on BBS, right? So now, Barb wants to know, and I don't know if this is relevant, but why only certain people are abducted? Do you find that, is there a certain type? Is there anything that these people have in common, or is there a certain person?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I can tell you that 88% of the experiencers who took part in my research project stated that they had paranormal experiences in their home. Also, a very, very high percentage stated that they are either psychic or intuitive. And it's not clear whether they were this way before their first experience, or if it is a product of having been taken. But there seems to be a high level of intuitive people, psychic people, and empathic people as well, who are experiencers.
That's interesting. I mean, there's obviously some intuitives that are not abducted. I mean, I'm a professional medium myself.
Yeah.
I don't think I've been abducted, but you never know. And how about locations, certain areas? I mean, it seems like old country roads and stuff where they're not going to be seen, going to be able to come in and get out unseen. It seems to be, I guess, important to them. But are there certain locations in the world that there's just so much activity?
Well, I have to tell you, and I don't know if it's because it's an English-speaking country or not, but there's an awful lot of activity in Australia. And I hear about this also in New Zealand and across the United States and Canada. The MUFON receives about 3 reports a week. So that's quite a large number.
Mm. And would that be like Australia is a big place. So would that be kind of like just in Melbourne or just, you know, just all over the place?
It's all over the place. It really is. And, you know, I don't know about the countries that speak foreign languages because I don't hear from those people. We can't communicate with one another.
Well, how about the UK?
The UK, yes. Yes, MUFON has a chapter in the UK, and they have received a number of abduction reports or contact experience reports.
I wonder if it's just possible that other countries that don't speak English, they keep to themselves or, you know, they handle it a different way.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if they are being visited at the same rate as well. But, there's a language barrier.
Well, let's talk about just the United States itself. Are there certain states that are visited more than others?
I don't think so.
Okay, so it's really pretty even.
We do have some states where there hasn't been one abduction report. I've received several in the state of Florida. In New Hampshire, when I lived up there, I'd received several. There are several in California, but it seems to be fairly evenly distributed.
Is it always in quiet places where, you know, a quiet, dark country road?
Well, you know, I asked that question for my commonality study and discovered that there are slightly more that occur in rural locations or small towns than in urban areas, but it's fairly evenly distributed.
Oh, okay. Just trying to find this common denominator. Now, I live in Pennsylvania, big farm country, so mm-hmm. I'm always – do you, like, get crop circle reports a lot?
Not that many, as far as I know. You know, just a few. That's not my area of expertise. Those
reports go to another section. Right, right. I just thought, you know, I'd take a chance to the closest I've got right now.
But I can tell you we've had several experiencer reports in Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania, yeah.
Ranging from out in a rural area to Philadelphia.
Because we have all those country roads, for sure.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
tell me, Kathleen, how can people get in touch with you after the show? Or where can they order your books? Your website, phone, email? Go ahead.
Yes, my website is Kathleen, K-A-T-H-L-E-E-N, -Marden, M-A-R-D-E-N. You can order an autographed copy of my book from my website. There are also several articles that you can read for free, and you can read about where I'm going to be speaking this year. My books are also available in bookstores and on Amazon or barnesandnoble.com, so you can order them there as well.
That's great. You know, I can't believe how fast the time is going. Maybe we lost a little time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be on the show today. A million thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye. Okay, before we go, I just want to tell you a little bit about the Ayoshi cards. Now, if you have not had your free reading online yet, go to ayoshicards.com. That's ioshicards.com. You can also reach that link from spiritnetwork.com. If you have problems in your relationship, job, money issues, simply ask a question and click on the 3 cards and your answer will be revealed. Now, if you'd like to be a sponsor on Spirit Network, don't forget we have many advertising options, very cost effective. Just email radio@spiritnetwork.com. Okay, friends, I want to thank you so much for being here. Much love. Bye.
You've been listening to Spirit Network Radio. For more information about the show, please visit spiritnetwork.com. For more information about your host, psychic medium Francine Milano, visit her website at francinemilano.com. Until next time, remember that peace begins with an open heart.